You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is, once again, the mother of all podcasts, The Brian Callen / Hunter Moss Show. Our guest, Yuni Hong, has written a book called The Birth of Korean Cool, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. And I was telling Yuni before we started this that I picked up the book and I was like, all right, well, let me see. What does this mean? I was thinking about the birth of Korean cool, and I was thinking about Psy, who sings Gangnam Style, you know, and I thought, well, all right, I don't know what to do about this. I read it. I could not put this book down. It was fascinating. It was fascinating because in a lot of ways you make the argument, and I think it's true, that Korea was able to do something that probably, in 15 years, that no other nation has been able to do. The United States has been able to do it, but for the most part, Korea has been able to export, become a pop culture force throughout the entire Asian world, and now becoming so in the Western world as well. They did it in about 15 years. It's something the United States has been doing forever, but Korea took a look at that American model and went, you know what? We can make a lot of money if we create really cool stuff, cool art, cool pop culture, music, movies, etc. And for Korea to be able to do that and to come from where they came is just incredible. So that's my intro, Yuni.
and just to yes and that, I would also say, I mean, I particularly love the fact that that pop culture revolution may also be how they bring down North Korea.
It's an ode to soft power.
Yeah, we recently had Professor Nye on, who coined the term soft power.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the whole time we were like, oh my God, we heard about it in theory, and now we're seeing it in practice with the birth of Korean cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that outlandish to surmise that, you know, that South Korean pop culture will be the unifying force between North and South Korea when you consider that historically in the 20th century that's happened over and over again. And I say that because throughout the 20th century, there are examples of this happening again and again, not with South Korea, of course, but with American pop culture being a very important undercurrent behind, for example, the Velvet Revolution in the former Czechoslovakia, where it was called the Velvet Revolution because the overthrowers, the anarchists, were listening to the Velvet Underground. This is not a new concept that pop culture can, you know, break barriers. And
yeah, and there was that great statistic that you had in there about how much it costs to buy a black market American movie in North Korea and how much it costs to buy black market South Korean movies in North Korea.
Right. The market for South Korean movies and shows is much, much higher. And, well, there are a couple of reasons for that. One, obviously, is that there's no language barrier. But another important one is that for North Korea, these South Korean dramas and songs are a symbol of hope, you know, because sort of the last generation that was aware of what life was like in the South before the divide, you know, they're sort of dying off. And so these sort of legends of you know, prosperity in the West and so forth, where, you know, they that's kind of too abstract. Whereas if they see these contemporary South Korean dramas, it really kind of, you know, I mean, unless you're really, really extremely brainwashed, you're going to go, okay, this does not at all fit in with what we are taught. Mm. These people do not really look like they're starving.
Right.
Okay, we were told they didn't have electricity. They definitely look like they have electricity.
Right.
You know, and so, and people are literally risking their lives to smuggle in these pop culture products in from South Korea. And it just shows you that for some people, pop culture is life or even more important than life, literally.
Yeah. Well, so let's go back for a second because Korea, my own experience, for what it's worth, one of the most influential people in my life was Korean, my Taekwondo teacher. One of the things that I got from this incredible guy was that it is a very austere group of people, the older generation, the generation that came out of Japanese colonialism, Korea, you talk about, is a peninsula that's been invaded 400 times. I've spoken to a number of soldiers, and I always used to ask, who are the toughest soldiers in the world? They almost always say probably the South Koreans, because their ability to endure hardship is just legendary. It is a rough, I mean, group. I mean, and you talk about something that I'd never heard before, which was Han. The concept of Han, sort of unquenchable lust for vengeance, the idea that you've been so wronged that your rage can never be quenched. My God. And it's a very real thing, isn't it? That's why so many movies and stories that come out of Korea are about vengeance.
Yeah, it really is. And it's funny that you mentioned that about a soldier saying that Korean soldiers are the toughest. I have heard that consistently, that that's their reputation. They kind of make them sound like the army of orcs, you know, in the Lord of the Rings or something.
Yeah.
But, to some extent, I mean, there's a reason for that. And in the book, I mentioned that Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond series, was somehow aware of this Korean stereotype. And Goldfinger is explaining why he has North Koreans as his manservants, including Oddjob. He's the guy who has the bowler
throws
hat.
Throws the hat, yeah.
Right. He decapitates people with bowler, and he's kind of grunting and, you know, stocky looking. He says Koreans are the cruelest people on earth.
Right. You think it says, I think it's the cruelest, most heartless people on earth or something like that. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And that's why they make good bodyguards. And as you say, there's actually a word for all of what we're describing, which is Han, which in English would be spelled H-A-N.
But you make, to stop you for a second, you make a really gutsy admission after you talk about that, which is to say, I hung my head and I had to say, you know what? He's kind of right. Like, I was like, geez, Uni, take it easy over here, man. But then you explain yourself, you know.
Right. I mean, it's one of these lines that's frequently cited as racist, but I kind of thought, how did he know? he must know a lot of Koreans. Were there a lot of Koreans in England in the 50s? I don't know. But so the word Han is, it's a kind of rage that only Koreans, by definition, only Koreans can have. And it's not just rage that you feel because of something that happened to you. It's inherited rage. It's basically racial memory rage. Mm-hmm. It's the rage of millennia. And I like to say it's the opposite of karma, because in the philosophy of karma, you can work off bad karma from life to life, and, you know, eventually you worked it all off. Han is exactly the opposite. It doesn't reduce from lifetime to lifetime. It increases and accumulates from lifetime to lifetime. Yeah. So it's not just anger or indignation, you know, like it's actually the sense that the world can never make it right. That, you know, you will try to seek vengeance, but you know that it will make you feel better. And a really good example of this is the Korean revenge thrillers. The most famous being Old Boy.
Incredible movie. Incredible movie, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there's actually, you know, that's part of his revenge trilogy. And there are a couple of other Korean directors who do revenge movies. And the big difference between the Korean revenge drama and, you know, the American, I forgot what that series, you know, American vigilante drama, is that in Korean vigilante drama, the person seeking vengeance knows that it is not going to do him any good. You know, in one movie, you know, the guy is trying to go after his nemesis. In the process, his wife gets raped and murdered. He might lose his child. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
It will not make him stop, no matter what the losses are. Even if he knows he's jeopardizing everybody, he doesn't care. It's not about feeling better.
But the significance of that is that it really resonates across, you know, a large swath of the Korean population. They really identify, all of them identify with that, right?
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a culture where you're told, you know, to count to 10 before showing anger or something like that. It's generally accepted that anger is justified, even if it's not arising from the immediate situation, even if it's not obvious where it came from. The idea is, well, it must have come from somewhere, so let's let's see where this goes.
Yeah.
Let's hear this person out.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I know a man, an older man who spent time in a Korean prison. And he's as tough as it gets. I've never, in all my years, I think he's probably the toughest. There's a difference between a fighter and a killer, right? I mean, he was one of those guys. And he said that when somebody would be sentenced to death in the jail, this is in the 60s, that you would hear him laugh in defiance. His laughter would be echoing through the steel and cement, and that was just to show that he wasn't afraid to die. I mean, that was stuff that he would tell us, and I just remember just being a young man, you know, trying to get my black belt, and just being like, man, I'm such a pansy. I gotta be more Korean, man. Like, he would say things like, you know, when you have a son in Korea, you don't, the father does not touch his son. He doesn't touch or hug or kiss his son. Your son is made, you your daughter you protect, your son you forge. It's just like you're forging a sword. And again, as a kid, I was like, you damn right. I gotta eat some bibimbap, and I need some extra hot sauce, please. I always felt like such a pansy around my Taekwondo teacher.
Well, actually, when I watched the movie 300, you know, the one that was based on the comic.
Oh, you mean the movie? You mean the movie I watched, I don't know, 5 times, and I was in my 40s. Keep going.
Yes, right. Well, for those who don't know, it's about Sparta versus, I think, the Persian army, and it's called 300 because there are only 300 Spartans. And when I saw that, I thought, and they're describing the Spartan way of life, and you know, the sons are taken away from their mothers at age 7 to be warriors, and you know, if you're disfigured, you're basically thrown off a cliff. And I thought, this actually looks kind of familiar.
now, having said all that, you do an amazing job in the book of describing and bringing us through how Korea literally changed in a very short period of time. It used to be very uncool to be Korean, as you talk about.
Yeah.
You talk about the humiliation of eating kimchi with all that garlic and everything else. And now Korea learned how to go from being this very austere society, a very sort of regimented, it was a national duty to keep your lights off in school because Korea had to save money. And Korea learned a little something called irony, which is another way of saying Korea learned how to become cool in a very short period of time. And not only do they learn how to become cool, they have become, again, a pop culture force throughout the world. How did they do that in such a short period of time? Who were the key players? It's just incredible that they were able to do this stuff. I mean, they literally became, it was like almost an artistic revolution, right? I mean, they started with this sort of, but you know, you talk about their TV shows, and they were kind of matte and just very sort of derivative and not very good. And now they're creating incredible stuff, from music to movies to TV shows. How in the world did that happen in such a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, it's even hard for me to get my head around because, as you say, within a period of 15, maybe 20 years, Korea experienced changes that were as drastic as the Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution, but all rolled into one. It's something that a lot of countries would want to imitate if they could. So what happened basically, without going to the beginning of time, this basically started in the late 90s. It was after the Asian financial crisis. It was 97, 98, and the entire continent was devastated, including Korea. And the government realized that this exposed the fault line in the Korean economy, which was that the nation's GDP was overly dependent on the big companies like Samsung, LG, Hyundai. Those are the companies that made Korea, you know, prosperous, but the whole country was so dependent on them that if there was a bank crisis and these companies defaulted on their loans, then the country would also go into terrible debt, which is what happened. So the president at the time, Kim Dae-jung, and his government, his economic advisors, said, okay, we have to find another source of income. And they said, okay, what about this World Wide Web thing? You know, it's relatively new. There's no one country that has an obvious advantage over everybody else. This is an area where we don't have to play catch up. This is an area where we can actually just rip up all the existing infrastructure, lay down fiber optic cable, and we will be the number one most wired country in the world.
It's so brilliant, because you even talk about how I think the internet is 200 times faster in Korea than it is in this country.
Right. They're installing a 1 gigabit per second network, which is 200 times faster than what you would have in the U.S. or Western Europe.
God.
And, you know, you might think, well, who the hell needs to be that fast? But that's kind of like when I was in college and people were getting 16 megs of RAM for their computer. And I thought, well, who needs 16 megs of RAM? You know, you would just never think that people could use that much RAM or need that much speed. But of course you can.
Right.
And it's because Korea anticipated this, that they were able to use their, you know, brand-spanking new internet connection to export their pop culture. Because a lot of the Korean pop culture explosion rests on the music and the dramas. And by music, I don't just mean the music, I mean music videos.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people I know who fell in love with K-pop did not get like an MP3 download. They saw it. They saw it on YouTube. They saw the video. The visual component was really important. That's why it was so, so important to Korea to have super, super fast internet.
Mm-hmm.
They saw the internet not just as a way to get information into Korea, which they kind of didn't care that much about. They saw it as a way to send Korea out to the world for the first time ever, and they didn't have to buy ships, they didn't have to fly anything over,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have to, you know, make people like it, because the way that the internet works is people just kind of, like, you know, teenagers just have, they open their Facebook, or they open their, it's not idiomatically correct. They look at their Facebook, they look
right.
at their Twitter, and if their friend says, oh my God, you have to see this, it's hilarious, they're going to click on it. They're not going to say, this is a language I do not speak.
Right. It's the great democracy. It's the great sort of, you know. Hunter, what were you going to say?
Well, what I was going to say is, and this all comes back to a point made by one of your favorite South Korean economists, your father, which is that, you know, a lot of this comes down to the unique circumstances of South Korea not being able to really have a military, not really being able to use the military as a development pipeline for technologies. And so if they can't do that, then, you know, pop culture, the internet, things that are really soft power become the natural focus.
You know, that's exactly right. Every single country that was technologically advanced, except for Korea, was able to benefit from defense research. So, you know, everything from, you know, the microwave to jet planes. That's all from war technology, and it trickled down from the war industry to private industry, and, you know, and they're able to make everything from dental fillings to, you know, you name it. To better nylon stockings or whatever. Korea cannot do that. They have a special treaty with the United States that was signed after the end of the Korean War. So the war was 1950 to 1953. Korea cannot make autonomous military decisions without America's permission, basically.
Hmm.
So they have an army, and they have, but they can't just sort of say, we're going to develop nuclear weaponry, and it's really, we don't need the weapons, we just want the research. You know,
yeah.
They can't do that. They had to go the other way. I mean, in the modern day, technology either comes from war or from entertainment. Jurassic Park was a big example of that. And Jurassic Park, you know, was actually very, very important in the Korean government's discussions about, let's make Korea the pop culture factory of the world. We're going to use the United States as a model, even though we don't really have anything in common with them.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's kind of what is more amazing to me is that Korea's confidence, their confidence in the idea that, listen, we're this small country, relatively, it's a peninsula. We're very different than the United States in many ways. And
right.
yet the world is going to want what we have to offer, specifically our culture. our the fact that we can actually learn something called irony and how to be cool. That's an amazing leap of faith, in my opinion. That's amazing confidence for a country that, you know, has been invaded so many times. It's a testament, in my opinion, to their belief in themselves. I mean, talk about, you know, maybe it comes from Han. Maybe it's just, I don't know what it is, but that takes a lot of confidence in a nation. I don't know a lot of people that could do that. Like, it's fascinating to me.
It doesn't make any sense. And I can imagine that the people who proposed this at the time were probably laughed at. But there were a bunch of reports, official government reports, about Jurassic Park when that movie came out, saying this movie grossed as much as selling 15 million Hyundai cars. What are we doing? Why can't we do this?
Yeah, mm-hmm. let's get into the movie business. Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, this can't be that hard. You know, all you really need is time and talent. We have those things. Yeah. You know, let's just do it. And weirdly enough, that is pretty much exactly what they're doing. And they're developing a lot of entertainment technology. And one example is, and this was told to me by a bureaucrat in the Ministry of Culture. So the very highest levels of the Korean government, the country's best and brightest are on the pop culture project in Korea. And it is probably the most stressful job in Korea right now.
It's the most stressful job? Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that the government is doing is developing culture technology. And what that means is sort of the behind-the-scenes stuff that, well, in America, Industrial Light and Magic would do it. In Korea, the government pays for this. And one of the things they're working on is, like, super, super realistic three-dimensional holograms.
My job. Yeah.
No, exactly. You know, the idea is that, you know, a girl's generation or somebody can give a concert in Seoul and it can be live, quote unquote, in every city in the world and it will all look real. Now, right. Of course, we have holograms now, and P. Diddy did like a hologram appearance at the American Music Awards 1 year. But first of all, you could tell it wasn't a human being. And second, the way that holograms work now is that you have to be looking at them from the front. If you're in order to see P. Diddy, if you're looking at the side, you actually don't see anything at all. And Korea's developing hologram technologies where you can see 360. Actually, all of us will be redundant at that point.
Yeah, I was going to say. But what's also very striking to me is mm-hmm. that if you had told me that Korea was going to be this hotbed of innovation. A lot of innovation requires irreverence for your ancestry, irreverence for how it was done before. And you know, I'm sure, and better than even I do, that the idea of coming up with something, you learn a skill from your teacher. The idea that then you're going to make it better or different can a lot of times be very antithetical to Korean character because your teacher would lose face because it would be considered disrespectful to your teacher. Just be a very good student. The Japanese suffer from this. That's why there's not a lot of innovation. There's a lot of mimicry, all due respect to Japan. Korea seems to have bucked that. Korea seems to have, I would have told you from my experience, that was a tall order. And what does my experience matter? I don't know enough about Korean culture, but I certainly, from what I've read, that has always been a characteristic that has been put upon Korean culture and Japanese culture, for that matter, not to compare the two. But would you agree with that? And don't you think that's kind of pretty amazing that they've been able to sort of take what feels like a strong characteristic of Korean culture, the mm-hmm. idea that your teacher is king, and to mm-hmm. do something different or would be or do it better than your teacher was sort of heretical, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, it was and is highly, highly disruptive. But this is where the irony part comes in. And, you know, one of the arguments I make in the book is that irony is a privilege of wealthy nations mm-hmm. Because, you know, a poor country or a developing country has to focus on things like clean water. And it would be obnoxious to say, wait a minute, are our values changing too quickly? Is technology making us soft? You know, you can't sort of say these things until the country gets wealthy. Mm-hmm. Korea was able to do this. I for some reason, Japan didn't quite do this And I don't want to really speculate why. They're culturally quite different. They're much more inward looking, for one thing. Meaning that Japan, despite a long, a successful period at export, has basically decided kind of not doing that anymore. So they're not as concerned about what the world thinks about them.
Because they did have a tradition of, there's some great Japanese film that came out of Japan. I don't know if it still is. But.
There is, but I think that's the thing. The book that this actually made me really think of as a companion piece is Startup Nation. Which, is all about the success of Israel's tech sector and all of that stuff. And the central factor that they identify is what Brian's talking about, which is dissent, right? The willingness to question, the willingness to challenge authority constantly. I think it's very interesting to see these two books side by side.
That doesn't surprise me that coming from Israel, that's part of the Jewish character. The debate and the idea. I mean, Christ, Moses argued with God himself. He's like, you're giving me a raw deal. So that's always been the case, which is probably why so much innovation has come out of, the Jewish culture and things. But not so with Korea. Not so, in fact.
Yeah. And you really talk about the Confucian ethic.
Yes. Confucianism, of course, was widespread throughout Asia, but it took a stronger hold in Korea than it did anywhere else. And part of Confucianism is sort of blind obedience, not just to teachers, but to hierarchy in general. And the idea is whole society is hung together by this very delicate cobweb, and if you do something wrong, you're not just affecting yourself, you're hurting every single other person. Rebellion is has wide-reaching consequences. So there is that. That's not a small thing. On the other hand, Korea, as you mentioned, is a country that's been invaded 400 times. China and Japan were sort of the ones doing the invading. And I think that this the difference between being attacked and attacking is kind of gets to the heart of the ways in which Korea and Israel are actually similar. There are huge differences in the cultures. Like, for example, the role of, the role of the matriarch is very, very different in Israeli culture than from Korean culture. But there are a lot of similarities, too. I don't know if people know this, but both Korea and Israel in their modern iterations were formed in the same year, 1948.
I didn't know that. Did not know that.
And both of them, because it was a new country, they used national anthems that were not locally written. Israel used an old Italian song, and Koreans used Auld Lang Syne.
Wow.
They changed it, but, it's all sort of part of the same thing, which is like we're building a nation from scratch. We need a national anthem, da-da-da-da-da. And, both countries have special relationships with the United States that limit the kinds of things that they can do. They have no natural resources. They have a highly, highly educated population. And what goes hand-in-hand with that is high white-collar unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of in the same boat where they're like, okay, let's pat ourselves on the back that we have such smart people. However... we're losing a lot of them to Silicon Valley and so forth because those places have innovation. We need to find ways to keep people in the country. And that's how Korea and Israel both sort of decided, we have to have more of a culture where disruption is welcome, where questioning is welcome. And I was actually at an embassy event, consulate event, rather, where they were talking about Korea, why can't Korea be a startup nation, basically. And one of the things they said is, we don't have anyone who dropped out of college and became somebody like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, because you talk a great deal at length about how learning for Koreans is not supposed to be fun. And school is taken very seriously to the point where teachers are bribed. You have these private study halls where people, kids are spending, till 11 o'clock at night. The government had to come down on it. They're like, you guys are studying too much. And the suicide rate in Korea, I think, is the highest in at least the Asian industrial world. Is that true?
I think it's the highest in the entire industrial world, actually.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Is that still the case, even though Korea's made such strides?
Yeah. It's not a contest you want to win.
No.
Yeah, this is not a suicide-loving culture. There's no sort of tradition of, like, samurai, you know, if you commit a suicide, you can, you know, you can save your family's honor. It has nothing to do with that. Mm. It is purely the high stress. Well, this actually goes back directly to Confucianism, because in the Confucian system, as it was practiced in Korea, this was not true in every country, but in Korea, you could become an aristocrat and make your whole family an aristocratic family by passing a really difficult exam.
Wow.
So that was the good news. A man from almost any social class could take this exam and completely, you know, change the bloodline to a blue bloodline. The bad news is that a man in your family had to retake the exam once every three generations.
Oh, no pressure.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah. So number one, this means obviously that you have to have sons. Number two, this means that, if you don't study, if you don't pass this exam, you are screwing up not only the people who, you know, not only your descendants, but you're dishonoring the people before you, you know, your ancestors who made this happen. That is a lot of pressure. And even though Confucianism hasn't really been the dominant belief system for a long time, it was for almost 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Those things die hard. They die hard.
It's not going away.
No.
And in fact, I talked to some Korean government officials involved in education, and they said, we know that this is a problem. We don't like that we have a lot of student suicides. And they said, but everything we've tried to do to fix this has failed. We tried to make the university system more like the admissions, rather. We tried to make college admissions more like American college admissions, where it's not just your grades and it's not just your test scores. We wanted to take into account sports and music, extracurricular type activities, volunteer work. And then they said this backfired.
Yeah, because then now they're trying to add even more to their workload, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nation of studyaholics, and I'm not actually kidding. I mean, it's really a genuine addiction in the way that gambling or alcohol is an addiction. You cannot take it away from them.
Mm-hmm.
God.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's not healthy. I don't think Korea is very psychologically healthy, but this is one of the reasons behind how it went from being one of the poorest countries in the entire world to one of the richest.
In such a short period of time, too.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and one of the things that I thought was really interesting is when you were talking to the Ministry of Education and they'd abandoned their e-reader program. There was a plan where they were going to give every kid an e-reader, and then they were like, yeah, it's not worth it because technology is not what makes for education.
Yes. Well, that's exactly, that gets to the heart of there's a multi-way tug of war between, you know, the parents and students and what the teachers want and what the government wants. The government wants technology all the way. They're the ones who wanted the e-readers. The teachers and the people who represent them, you know, just sort of want to go, they say, this is going to undermine respect for teachers. You have no idea what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the students and parents are just like, well, you know, they're just very kind of looking out for themselves. And, you know, regardless of what happens, they're constantly trying to find a way to game the system.
Do you think North Korea is such a thorn in everybody's side. I've heard that North Korea actually has enough artillery aimed at Seoul to just set it ablaze. I mean, I'm talking about conventional weapons. I mean, so South Koreans are living under this constant and very strange threat from the North. The North has to know, by the way, if they were ever to do something like that, it would be the end of their frickin' regime, and it's an evil one. But you talk about how, you know, they have these strange TV shows with North Korean women well-dressed talking about what life was like and trying to break down
and playing the accordion.
I mean, it literally sounds like hell where everybody in North Korea likes the accordion and there's no food. Talk about one of Dante's rings. Oh my God. That's the very lowest ring. That's the center of the earth. I mean, wow. Is North Korea really that bad?
No, it does seem to have the worst combination of having vast famine and the most annoying possible form of musical entertainment being really, really popular. They love the accordion. And yeah, this show that you're talking about, which is called Now on My Way to Meet You, is a South Korean panel show, which is like a combination of the Lawrence Welk show and Oprah and the Miss America pageant.
Nice.
And Schindler's List. So you have these really beautiful girls from North Korea, you know, who are dressed in Prada. And the first half of the show is they come out and play the accordion. So that's the Lawrence Welk part of the show. And the second half of the show is just horrible stories about being raped and tortured and how hard it was to escape from North Korea. And in all cases, it took several years. It's one of the biggest paradoxes in modern geopolitics, that the most repressive regime in the world borders what is arguably the coolest country in the world. And it's leading to some really weird consequences, like the fact that Seth Rogen is starring in a movie that that makes fun of Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sure Kim Jong-un does not like this at all. Something really messed up has happened with North Korean PR.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe 50 years ago, people were afraid of them. It was like Nikita Khrushchev. It was like Iron Fist. They were afraid of being killed by these guys. And now it's a joke. And it's the subject of a comedy with Seth Rogen in it. And nobody takes this guy seriously at all.
Good.
Yeah, good. But it's sort of like, yes, of course they could annihilate Korea and many more countries. But nobody really thinks that that is a... The laughability has exceeded the fear.
Yeah, not even they are that stupid.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem is, I mean, what you talk about in the book is that their whole strategy, I mean, there are a bunch of criminals, right, the North Korean regime, and they rely on everybody thinking that they're crazy. And you can only play the crazy card so many times before the world realizes you're not actually going to do it because you know you would get wiped out.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's that irony and the culture that is diffusing in there that, I mean, as you say, it's a soft power that may really destroy North Korea where bombs could not.
Mm. Right, exactly. Because the idea of odd job is not really compatible with the idea of Psy or Girls' Generation. You know, they can't coexist in this world, and it's clear that it's Psy and Girls' Generation that are going to win over odd job.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting, though, also is that you talk about North Korea being one of the most oppressive societies, but, you know, control, the idea of control, the South Koreans, as cool as they are, also seem to be in some ways in love with oppressing themselves by their own hand. And as a couple of examples, not only just this obsession with study, but you talk about, and it was shocking to me, how much plastic surgery there is in Korea, how important appearance is, how important it is to be a good boy, a good girl, and not be, naughty, not be, you know, somebody you could, if you were ever to talk about how many men you slept with, even if you're a huge pop star, it would be a bad situation for you. So South Korea still has a great deal of oppression in its own, that sort of self-inflicted oppression, or at least they are control freaks when it comes to everything from their appearance to their reputation. Is that true?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. And this is one of the strange paradoxes, that the thing that in many ways is the most difficult and unpleasant about Korean life is also one of the reasons why their pop culture is doing so well. What do I mean by that? Well, for example, a typical K-pop star's contract will be 13 years long.
That's their contract. It's incredible.
Yes. And, you know, what's the reason for this? Well, they're recruited from age 12 or so. It's just like a Romanian gymnast. And they're trained for 5-7 years in singing, dancing, even etiquette, and, you know, crowd management before they're even allowed to perform in public. So if you think about, if they're spending 7 years training the person, they lose money on that. So of course the contract kind of has to be 13 years long. Mm. You know, very few other countries would even consider this a legal contract.
Right.
You know, which is why Korea was able to accelerate their, you know, their pop star making machine.
It seems to work. I was going to say, I mean, it seems to work. The dancers are incredibly in sync and they are putting out music that the world wants to hear.
I mean, I think they were one of the things they were out to prove and that gave them confidence was there's nothing that cannot be achieved through study.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know? Not only that, but I thought it was very eye-opening to think that if you told me that government intervention would actually foster artistic productivity, I don't know about innovation, but productivity, I would have told you were crazy. But in fact, it was deliberate government programs and intervention and planning that created this crazy phenomenon, or at least certainly aided its acceleration.
Well, that's exactly right. The government of Korea played a very critical sort of marionette role in this whole thing. Korea knew that they couldn't follow the U.S. pattern exactly.
Right. So
they had to kind of force it, and they knew that nobody was really going to watch Korean dramas just because they felt like it. First of all, the Korean language is only spoken in Korea. Second of all, most people had never really heard of this country. There was no demand for any of this. So about 20 years ago, the South Korean government decided to pay for translating Korean dramas into other languages. So they paid for it to be translated into Chinese. They continue to do this, even though it's arguably not commercially necessary anymore. They pay for it to be translated into Spanish. They pick obscure languages to be translated into. The government pays for all of this.
Mm.
So that all the local market has to, and they negotiate. They broker directly. The Korean government brokers directly either with the networks in other countries or with, in the case of Cuba, with the governments in other countries. And Korean pop dramas are really popular in Cuba.
Well, the book could have also been called Anything Is Possible. I mean, because it really is astounding. I don't want to give too much away because we want to promote the book. And the book, again, is The Birth of Korean Cool by Yuni Hong, How One Nation is Conquering the World Through Pop Culture. And it's just fascinating,
and there's so many great tidbits and anecdotes. I mean, that's what makes it so readable is that it's like, oh, fun little story. You're just constantly going from fun little story to fun little story, and then you get a big picture as you go through.
I hope you keep writing. What's your next book? What are you working on now?
Oh, well, I don't really discuss ongoing projects. So whenever I get asked that, I say that I'm working on a rock musical about the collaboration between Meatloaf and his songwriter, Jim Steinman.
Damn. All right. I like that. We'll be looking. When you get that done, we'll read that book and we'll have you back on.
That would be great.
Yuni Hong, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Fascinating. We'll see you later. That's Yuni Hong, ladies and gentlemen. The Birth of Korean Cool. This has been Brian Callen. And that other guy, well, he's the Dutchman with the tailpiece they call Hunter Maats. M-A-A-T-S. Listen, we love your comments on Twitter, by the way. Thank you for all your comments and your suggestions, like oiling my chair. I got to start oiling my chair, which I haven't done. be like, oil your podcast chair, man. I can hear it creaking. And you're right, but deal with it, dude. Maybe that's my back and I'm old.
Oh,
man, I'm going to box right now. You know how sore I am? I boxed yesterday. I'm going to box again and have Wayne McCullough, world champion, punch me in the face. And it reminds me.
That's a good use of your brain, man.
Makes me feel alive, brother. Yeah. Makes me feel alive.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.